Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. This is Ellie Steele, and tonight I'm going to read chapters 3 and 4 of my new book called The Naked at the Mic, The Survival of a Liberal in Times of Peril. And tonight we're going to read chapters 3 and 4. And I, last week, last Thursday, we did 1 and 2 in the introduction. I noticed that we had a number of a good number of listeners. I appreciate your checking me out, and I thank you for a lot of my listeners. I want to thank all of you for going into my archives. I see a lot of activity in the archive section, and I appreciate that. Thank you. I hope you pass it on. Hope you tell people about it. This book that I'm reading now is coming out. I hope to be out in December. It's completed and it's at the publishers, and the publisher is trying to get it. Hopes we'd like to get it out before the Christmas for the Christmas part of market, you know. So hopefully it'll be great, and we can do it. Again, the book is called Naked at the Mic: The Survival of a Liberal in Times of Peril. I published it online. A few chapters, but that was a previous draft. It was before I even before I had a publisher, and I changed it. That it was called "Naked at the Mic," but it was also called "Defense of Liberalism," and it's on my website now. I have the first 11 chapters, I think, on there, but. Yeah, there have been a lot of changes since I put those up, so there, it's now in book form, and it's published ready and almost print ready, we hope. So that should be coming out in December. I'll have it on my website. I'll have it everywhere that I can, so it'll be available. It'll be available at Barnes & Noble and at Google. Google search and Amazon search, and there'll even be an ebook available of it at a modest price by the publisher, and there will be a and of course that'll be available on my own website, and all of this will be available on my site. I just wanted to make that known. That this is coming out in, we hope, in December, middle of December, it looks like, hoping. So what I wanted to do tonight is I wanted to, read the third and fourth chapters. And I hope you enjoy them. Took a lot of work to write this. Took me almost 5 years to write this book. It doesn't seem like that long ago. The origins or the foundation of the book crew was started about that time, right when I got my I got the radio show in 2003, and we've been working at it since. Hang on 1 second here. I'm just going into my. We're going to read chapter 3 and 4 tonight. Now, I wanted to say there's 16 chapters, and I'll just read the table of contents so you know which chapters are coming up. Chapter 1 was Chaos, Crisis, Content, and Criticism. Chapter 2 is the Stupidity and Chaos surrounding the beginning of the Iraq War. And chapter 3, which we'll be reading tonight, is Ronald Reagan, the president of the cult of conservatives. Okay. And number 4 is a smorgasbord of Democratic candidates. The fifth chapter 5 is called The Assassination of Liberalism. Chapter 6 is a censorship and 911 truth. Chapter 7 is Jesus was a liberal.
chapter 8, the Blue Collar Republicans. Chapter 9, The Theft of a Nation by Deaf, Dumb, and Blind Liberals. Chapter 10, The Creation of the Radical Underground. Chapter 11, The Moment of Radical Realization. Chapter 12, The Public Relations Princess of the Political Left. Chapter 13, Environmental Menaces from the Left and Right. Chapter 14, Going to War with Iran. Chapter 15, The Times They Are Changing. Chapter 16, Politics and Metaphysics. And then the second part of this book is called Essays and Insights. It's based on my web journal from 2004 to 2009. They are all the many essays that I've written between 2004-2009. There's actually 164 of them selected out of about 700, and from dating from 2004 to 2009 on the different topic different areas of my that I wrote on. Some were the six areas that I broke the essays into were national politics, international politics, patriotism, satire, mainstream media, and metaphysics. And I've written over 700, 800 published articles in these areas. So I just wanted you to know that that's what was coming up. That's what the book is. And it's approximately about 149,000 words or so. And it's quite more than a super novel, unfortunately, but I hope it's entertaining. I've had good reviews from my editors, and they feel it's very strong. And then the areas that they wanted to help me correct, or have me correct, were the were corrected. So we're in pretty good shape. The book looks great, and there's 25 pictures in it. Not all of me. For sure, most of them from different people, heroes that I have. This is Joe Bessay and good friend Bill Marshall. Just a number of people, and the guys at the railroad radio station, Dennis Jackson and Joe Lavero, and. The pictures of the people that have stuck with us all this time, or that we've met, that have made significant impacts on us. I say us, I mean Lila and myself. And so I think that it's rather an autobiographical account of what's happened, but at the same time, most of it is. Most of it is significant and relevant. So let me begin with Chapter 3, Ronald Reagan, the President of the Cult of Conservatives. On June 5th, 2004, Ronald Reagan took his last breath on Earth. According to all conservatives, fundamentalists, and Republicans, his soul ascended into heaven, where he sits with the former chairman of General Electric and speaks directly to George W. Bush. After the unendurable public homage that blessed his soul before God and man, Ronald Reagan was finally laid to rest. He had a long and interesting life that few except for Nancy and his kids will ever know. His public life was loved by many until his Hollywood makeup wore off and the movie script speeches ended. Then the world saw him for what he was, just a power-crazed reactionary in a plaid suit. The media, as usual, managed to cover up his mental collapses and Alzheimer's episodes, witnessed by many close to him. I always wondered if it was just part of the role he played so well, the role of the old, always smiling, always laughing, and forgetful grandfather, dressed in plaid suits and dyed brown hair, in a mea culpa. I must admit, I actually voted for him in 1980. Yes, I'm admitting it. I actually voted for Ronald Reagan in 1980 and again in 1984. The reason for my decision was I absolutely, positively hated Jimmy Carter and could not trust Walter Mondale and Gerald Dean Ferraro. What the hell were the Democrats thinking about? 1980 was the year the Democratic Party died, but they weren't officially buried until November 3rd, 2004. I wrote their obituary on my website, which appears in the satire segment of essays and insights in this book. Like all vampires, the Democrats went into a long sleep, regaining their strength in darkness to eventually rise again and victimize the American public. I don't wish to go into my own checkered past of how I wholeheartedly fell for the American dream and worked hard at developing a successful business, only to see it destroyed by the stupid economic policies of Jimmy Carter and watch the United States sink into a massive recession where 18 and 21% 30-year adjustable rates were all that were available to an average homeowner or homebuyer. In 1980 and 1881, large and small businesses failed by the hundreds of thousands around the country. In the late 70s, Americans waited hours in gas lines and odd and even days to fill their tanks. Gas prices were rising daily because of the OPEC boycott and deliberate rigging of oil prices by the big oil companies to raise oil prices to $35 and $40 a barrel. That was back in 1980, in the late 70s. Yeah. Equating then to slightly over $1 per gallon at the pump, 100% rise in less than 1 year, and under the leadership of G.W. Bush and Barack Obama, those gas prices seemed like an incredible bargain. But when adjusted for inflation, $3 and up a gallon is about equally as outrageous. And on top of this sudden and painful indignity by OPEC, Iran and the Ayatollah Khomeini, the revolutionary leader of Iran, whose favorite pastime was watching Bugs Bunny cartoons, managed to attack the U.S. Embassy and capture and hold 52 American hostages for 435 days without any retaliation by the U.S., except for one long delayed attempt by a small special forces team. That team's helicopter crashed in the desert due to a mechanical failure. Some members of the group were killed and captured. By then, everyone in the country had enough of Jimmy Carter and his idiot brother, who pissed on the side of every federal building in Washington, D.C., and took money from anyone or any country who would give it to him to buy influence with Libya or his brother, Jimmy. Those are a few reasons why I voted for Reagan, and his tinkle-down economic policies were better than anything the Democrats were offering by the big smile, corporate-kissing, nuclear-loving, New World Order peanut farmer from Plains, Georgia. Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter got us into this mess, and Ronald Reagan got us out of it for a short while by tripling the national debt, giving tax breaks to the wealthiest 1%, revising tax laws to cripple the middle classes, tripling military spending, cutting welfare entitlements by creating 2 million homeless, and killing hundreds of thousands of Central Americans by his support of right-wing death squads. We must never forget Ronald Reagan's support of Iraq in Saddam's war against Iran that killed 1 million people by conventional and chemical weapons that the Reagan administration sold to both sides. Remember the Iran-Contra affair? By October 1987, the country was in the worst stock market bust since the Great Depression, and the near out-of-control real estate boom of the mid-80s came to a screeching halt with the new Reagan tax law of 1987 that destroyed the middle class, completely demolished the lower middle classes, and annihilated the poor. Middle-class Americans were making too much money in the late 80s, because of Reagan and Volcker opening the floodgates of federal money and cheap loans that caused the same massive inflation of the Carter years. Republicans
can't stand it when too many people make money, regardless of how worthless that dollar may become. After all, Republicans were always the elite party of big business. It was the Democrats that were supposed to look out for the little guy. That all changed under Carter. Reagan and the Republicans saw the opportunity they had been waiting for, that they thought they would never see again after Nixon's resignation and Ford's defeat. The great Republican push to have FDR's face removed from the dime and replaced by Ronald Reagan's was probably appropriate. Reagan had more to do with the devaluation of the American dollar than anyone else in history. The value of the American dollar in 1981 was worth 10 times more than the dollar in 2009. And proof of that statement is in 1981, average U.S. home values for a single 3 to 4 bedroom home in livable condition were selling at $35,000 to $60,000. By 1988, the price of the average home doubled and in some states tripled in value. And today they are selling between $350,000 to $600,000. In 1981, a loaf of bread was 20 cents. A gallon of gas was less than a dollar. In 2009, a loaf of bread is over $2. And for other than white enriched bread, the cost is over $3 per loaf. And gasoline soared to over $4 per gallon thanks to the Wonder Bread years of Reaganomics, Carter incompetence, Clinton complacency, Daddy Bush's Gulf War, and Baby Bush's special ed economics program, and brain-dead warmongering diplomacy. Only since late 2008 have gas prices gone down to below $2 per gallon, and yet the price per barrel of oil has shrunk back to less than $40 per barrel. In 2009, prices are near $3 a gallon again. I have been jumping ahead of myself, talking about the Reagan effect on the national mindset, but I wanted to prove a point. I was caught up in the insane system as well for a while because I felt I had two choices, bad or worse. It so happened both were worse in 1980. What was a red-blooded, bull-headed American male supposed to do? Vote for a wimp like Carter? Well, I did it. Cast my first Republican vote for president, and I have regretted my decision ever since because it helped lay the groundwork for the election of Big Daddy and Baby Bush, and George Bush Sr. came in the back door through Reagan. Few people liked or trusted him in 1988, but when compared to the Democrats' choice of Dukakis, it was one choice. I would vote my vote in my vote for Jesse Jackson that year. I was floored by his great convention speech. By 1992, the choices were clear. I and 20% of voting Americans voted for Ross Perot. Even though Perot had officially dropped out of the race, my vote was a protest vote, as were millions of others that got Clinton elected. I still don't know what we got with Clinton, other than his wife, a year of impeachment proceedings, and redefining oral sex as not a sexual act. Under George Sr., we got the first Gulf War and the formal introduction to the New World Order, and another tax increase to pay off the Reagan-Bush deficit. That brought a booming economy to a screeching halt. And wrong tactic, George. Should have thought more like your son and just printed up more money. What the hell, after Carter and Reagan, the dollar became virtually worthless anyway. The Reagan legacy wasn't really understood until his death. Then, once the sickening accolades of the conservative and the liberal media fumigated the American public with a cheap perfume of hypocritical eulogies, those who knew what Reagan really stood for heaved in nauseating disgust. The artificial resurrection of Reagan's political swagger by Baby Bush in the 2000 campaign and his parody of Ronald Reagan became nothing more than a cartoon creation of a pre-made cardboard Republican icon. The only remote comparison of Ronald Reagan and GW is that both were fixated on one wrong idea.
Ronald Reagan was under the illusion that all Americans were or should have been rich Republicans. His grand vision was to feed the rich and kill off the poor. He started out middle class, as he felt most Americans should, and by making a few good choices and with a little luck, they too could become sports announcers, movie actors, General Electric spokesmen, governor of California, and president of the United States. One big idea is all he had, but it was all he needed to fool the American public into blind optimism. Baby Bush had many big ideas, but never stuck to any of them, except invading and staying in Iraq. Nor does he have the mental capacity to think any of his ideas through. Ronald Reagan created his own image, whatever that really was. He made people like him, almost trust him. He didn't seem to be a guy who would willfully lie. It took 6 years of his presidency before the mask wore off and the actor started to misread his script. In his second term in office, everything was going down the tubes. Iran-Contra was in full view. His Star Wars delusion of world military domination was discovered by all in the know as an impossible dream. Billions went into building up a peacetime defense without any apparent enemies. Homelessness, tax cuts for the rich, and the soaring soaring government and private debt were the wave of the 80s. Reagan's undying devotion and loyalty to big business and defense contractors such as General Electric and his ease of telling the big lie is the ugly tale of the dragon of the Reagan legacy. Ronald Reagan released the caged dragon. He unleashed the military-industrial complex and championed murderous dictatorships around the world, calling them freedom fighters. Serious doubts surfaced about his capacity to understand what was happening around him. People around him began to wonder if he was really in control. Baby Bush was the cartoon parody of Ronald Reagan without any guesswork as to his mental capacity. GW was well known before his 2000 election as a poor communicator and less than capable of anything he attempted to do in his life without the continuous aid of his father and his father's friends. Ronald Reagan was supposedly self-made. I like Bedtime for Bonzo, Hellcats of the Navy, and several of his other films. As all enigmas are imitated, like Elvis and Michael Jackson, Ronald Reagan has his impersonators. It didn't take long before the fringe right-wing neocon and conservative kooks saw their chance to grab power from the unsuspecting American people, who were mesmerized by Reagan's hypnosis act of eternal optimism and post-World War II vision of a spotless America. And during the Reagan era, Christian cults flourished by fleecing the born-again, guilt-ridden American conscience. Television evangelists such as Tammy Faye and Jimmy Baker, Jimmy Swaggart, Oral Roberts, Pat Robertson, and Jerry Falwell, a silent majority, along with hundreds of smaller ministries, were all competing for the same charity buck. CTN television network exploded with the alms of millions of Americans as reformed alcoholics and drug-addicted singers crooned gospel songs, trying to convince their old and young American audiences that giving money to a television evangelist was guaranteed by God to increase their investment tenfold. Guarantees were testified and sworn to by as God's promise to members of the family's ministries, all ending by a shout of hallelujah. Now, how many poor, misguided souls still listen to the cynical pleas of these hucksters saying, give unto me and I will multiply your riches. These defrocked mercenary ministers of the 80s became the mutual fund salesmen of the 90s, and Reagan was a menace to America and a menace to the world. His legacy is the dementia inflicting our government today, with rampant corruption, a heartless indifference to the people our representatives are elected to serve. Liberalism was criminalized under and exiled under Reagan, and unions were demonized. Liberals have been fighting to repair and defend their honor ever since. Liberalism is a philosophy that embraces the good of mankind. In November of 2003, CBS created a biodrama about Ronald Reagan. It was an unauthorized version of his presidency portrayed by James Brolin, husband of Barbara Streisand. If it had been anyone else but Brolin playing Ronald Reagan, it might have caused less controversy. However, the casting director and executives of CBS had their own agenda and went ahead with their choice of lead actor. All the hoopla that surrounded its release was like Hollywood liberals kicking an active nationwide hornet's nest of conservatives. It was the first week of November 2003 when every conservative talk show in the country on television and radio was attacking CBS producers for coming out with this mad, made-for-television movie about Ronald Reagan. As I have noted, I really had little love for Ronald Reagan, but the guy was in his last year of life and was in the final stages of Alzheimer's. To put out a mean-spirited docudrama about a living president and the icon of American conservatism was just a completely stupid idea. They could have done this after his death, but instead they decided to promote it while he was totally incapacitated and unable to defend himself. I don't blame the right for jumping all over this, but what I do dislike is the so typical of conservative cultists was the Bible thumping and ganging up effect it had against all liberals. Since the stolen election, G.W. Bush in 2000, the fringe right started to beat their chests and create a threatening, aggressive defense of the system and the Republican Party. G.W. Bush, until 9/11, was at 30% national approval rating and falling. The talk of impeachment was everywhere, and the facts supporting Bush's stealing of the election were more than evident. The sad truth was that the Republicans did steal the election, but the laid-down, complicit media just rolled over and stopped reporting about it once the Bush and Reagan-appointed judges on the Supreme Court disallowed the Florida recount. The Christian right went hog wild defending the moral integrity of G.W. and the Republican Party, and the comparison of G.W.'s imitated style of Ronald Reagan became obvious. Calls for Reagan to be placed on Mount Rushmore and to replace FDR on the dime with a conservative obsession of the day, up through G.W.'s second stolen election in 2004. By November of 2003, the conservatives were very sure of themselves, and every cowardly conservative moron had undergone a courage transfusion by the liberal Democrat defeat in the House and Senate. Conservatives had ethnically cleansed the radio and television news mediums of all liberal talk shows and forced stations to dumb down all talk show formats to mimic the Fox News, Hannity, and Combs show. And almost everyone, except the L.A. Steel show, was silenced. And any insult, no matter how slight, regarding St. Ronald, was going to be seriously challenged. Conservatives regularly monitored my program and were waiting eagerly that first week of November 2003 to hear what I would say about the CBS Reagan movie. Well, the afternoon before that November 2003 show, Lila, my co-host, had just undergone hand surgery and was unable to be on the show that night. Well, Bill Marshall, my cosmobiologist and a regular on this program, had called earlier that day to say he would be late getting to the studio. I entertained the audience solo for the first hour. I hadn't mentioned the Reagan movie since I felt it wasn't an issue I wanted to bring up. And sometimes it's just not worth the aggravation to bring certain issues up on the air, especially when you know some of your listeners might use those issues to create a complaint against you. As I mentioned, I felt CBS was wrong to attack a living president when he was totally impaired and unable to defend himself. If nothing else, it just showed a lack of good sense and good taste. I was relieved when Bill arrived at the studio. It is much easier talking to someone in the studio when you are on the air rather than just talking to a microphone with no one else around. And Bill mentioned the Reagan docudrama as soon as he sat at the microphone. He said he didn't believe that any group had the right to demand censorship of a political movie, regardless of who or what it depicted. After all, this was America, and freedom of speech, freedom of speech was still a protected right. I forget, I used to love Billy was a good friend, fun guy, but he was really upset about that. But I said I agreed with him, but stated that I felt CBS was wrong in kicking Reagan when he was so vulnerable and unable to defend himself. And if the movie had been made and aired after his death, it would have been as big an issue. It wouldn't have been as big an issue. And this was all he said about the Reagan movie and went on to the other topics. Well, no one called the studio that night to complain about my comments. Instead, a conservative listener, excuse me, with a recent courage transfusion by the right-wing media defense of Ronald Reagan, called the station manager the next morning, complained vehemently about my comments and complained about my show's liberal format. And Joe, my station manager, defended my stance and said the station had nothing to do with the content of my program. Joe called me that morning and asked what I had said. I told him that I defended Reagan on the movie issue and had recorded the show and would play it back for him. He laughed and said, well, the person was really angry, but she was complaining about my show in general, and the Reagan remarks set her off. I thought that if I only got one complaint on that slight mention of Reagan, then very few people had a problem with it. That is more of the way my listeners respond to me. Perhaps I'm preaching more to the choir. But I know many conservatives listen, and some actually monitor the show each week. Few of my listeners ever complain anymore. I think it's because I attack the left as hard as I attack the right on many issues. And maybe no one agrees with me, but no one has ever complained that I'm a hand puppet or a mouthpiece for any political party. A few months after the Reagan docudrama issue, two friends and loyal listeners, Jan and John B., sent me an article and asked if I would read it on the air. It was written by a psychologist regarding the cult mentality of the religious right and the similarities, dangers, and characteristics bordering on psychotic obsessions and fascist nationalism. It was a well-written article, and unfortunately I have searched my archives for it but cannot find it to credit the author. My co-host Lila, who holds a master's degree in psychology and has been a school counselor for 20 years, felt that the article had great validity and wanted to read it on the air. And within minutes after reading the article, the phone began to ring persistently in the outer office until Lila left her microphone and went to answer it. She was gone for several minutes until I continued the show. Well, I continued the show, and I could hear her defending herself and asking the caller if she wanted to say her comments on the air. The caller denied and finished her tongue-lashing of Lila and hung up. Lila came back to the microphone and said, one lady seriously disapproved of being labeled a cultist. And we laughed and then went on with the show. It's amazing. It amazes me how someone can lie, cheat, steal, create a war, and have millions of ardent defenders. But the truth has very few defenders. Yet when it is spoken, it disarms and wounds all of its opponents. And in January of 2004, excuse me, I received a very strange invitation from CPAC, CPAC, their Conservative Political Action Conference. They invited me to their annual convention for grassroots activists and broadcasters to be held at the Ronald Reagan Building in Washington, D.C. They were inviting liberal talk show hosts that year. I declined the invitation, but I wrote an article about the invitation on my website, and I also read it on the air. The article is entitled An Invitation to Hell, and is included in the Essays and Insights sections of this book. And that's chapter 3. Chapter 4 is called The Smorgasbord of Democratic Presidential Candidates. In August of 2003, Howard Dean had begun a serious campaign for president and was making a lot of established Democrats extremely nervous. Especially, he was set up at the New Hampshire primary or was tripped up in Iowa. We may never know. The sudden appearance of the CBC televised conference with Howard Dean on video stating that caucuses should not be a part of the primary process wounded him gravely in Iowa, and his opponents continually ganged up on him in the debates and undermined his momentum with dirty tricks and negative campaigning throughout the primary process, cost Gephardt his political career and made everyone else look like idiots. Karl Rove must have been having belly laughs every day watching the Democrats run over each other. And during the several national Democratic debates, I began to wonder if all the candidates had practiced debating each other by watching old Three Stooges movies. Kerry was definitely the Moe character. Lieberman was Larry, and Dean was Curly. I don't mean to insult the beloved memory of Curly, but Dean was constantly being poked in the eye and hit over the head by everyone until he uttered frustrated and confused comebacks on par with Curly's "Gee, Moe, why'd you hit me?" or and whoop whoop whoop, and Gephardt, Edwards, Clark, Graham, Kucinich, Al Sharpton, and Carol Moseley Brum made up the silly cast of extras and actors of the now infamous comedy series never to be seen in reruns, the 2004 Democratic presidential primary debates. In August of 2003, a Dini baby friend of mine worked for the Dean campaign in Vermont on the weekends. I asked him if he could get Dean on the radio show, and he gave me the number to the media contact and the campaign headquarters. I called several times and got no answer for several days and complained to my friend. He said they were not fully together yet, and most of the people were part-time volunteers. He gave me a new email address and said to keep trying the phone number. After 2 weeks, I became totally frustrated from calling and emailing the official campaign number without even being able to leave a message on the answering machine because they didn't have one. I never received a reply to email inquiries either. And finally, one afternoon, I was determined to contact the Dean campaign. I had mentioned several times on the radio show how difficult it was to get anyone at the campaign office. That afternoon, at about 1 p.m., I called the campaign office, and someone actually answered. It was a young woman named Sally. She apologized for no one responding to my requests and said that the campaign phone was transferred to her house. I asked if she could get Howard Dean to be on my radio show, and she said that she had just hired a media contact person, and they were putting together a schedule for interviews. They would get back to me as soon as they completed it. She gave me the home phone number of the media contact and said he would be the one to contact from now on. I thanked her and hung up. I then tried the media contact number, which rang and rang without an answering machine. I began to wonder if anyone in Vermont had answering machines. It was 2003. Answering machines had been commonly used everywhere else in the country since the mid-80s. I was trying to reach a Democratic presidential candidate's campaign media contact, and they didn't even have an answering machine. I was beginning to have serious doubts about Mr. Dean's seriousness as a candidate. I also wondered how anyone in the press got hold of him, or if anyone ever did. As it turned out, after several weeks of calling newspaper reporters and other people in the media I knew, they all said that they were trying to do stories on Dean but couldn't get anyone to respond to them. By September of 2003, the Dean campaign had an answering machine, but no one to respond to the media emails. I was put off for several weeks by the new campaign media contact until I got him on the phone one morning and asked him if and when I could get an interview with Dean. He said he would mention it at a meeting he was having with Dean that afternoon and see if he could get him to do the show the following week. I never heard from him again. After a dozen phone calls, the messages left on his answering machine, after calling a new number given to me by a friend who worked for the campaign, I was able to speak to someone who informed me that they didn't know who the media contact person was or who Sally was or anyone I had mentioned by name. She stated that so many people were volunteers and came and went. I asked her if I could get an interview with Dean or could I get an interview with Joe Trippi. And she said it would be easier to interview Dean. I finally gave up hope of getting an interview with anyone from the Dean campaign and didn't bother again. I sent several emails in support of his candidacy because of the few articles and statements he made against the Iraq war and Bush's disastrous economic policies, but I got no replies. I found out later that Dean had ignored many requests for interviews, even from statewide and national shows. Once I learned of this, I no longer felt snubbed, since everyone else was ignored as well. In late October, early November of 2003, I watched a C-SPAN discussion by several of the Democratic campaign managers and advisors. The commentator asked the question if they were getting any support from radio talk shows. All but one said they weren't because it was too early in the race. Well, Dean's strategist sat back proudly and said, "Yes, we have been getting good coverage from a small radio station in Northwest Connecticut. The show's host has endorsed Dean. He probably didn't even remember the show's name or the call letters of the station, but I was certain he was talking about the L.A. Steel Show because I was the only talk show host in the area that came out early and supported Dean and spoke about the campaign often. I figured my billion phone calls and emails must have been read by someone, and maybe my Deany baby friend mentioned my show a few times at the campaign office. It appeared odd that they would pinpoint my station's location, mention my endorsement, and still not contact me or respond to my request for an interview with Dean. This was one of the major problems with the Dean campaign, their arrogance toward the alternative media. Okay, alternative media radio hosts were promoting Dean's campaign at its beginning and brought his name forward to their listeners and the activist communities. By January of 2004, Dean was doing only major news media outlets and was on the covers of major magazines. His campaign had taken off and the internet was paying his way. All other candidates in the Democratic smorgasbord were seriously pathetic. John Kerry was first to announce his candidacy. He reminded everyone of the idiot tank man Michael Dukakis and a hypocrite from Hyannis Ted Kennedy. And Kerry pulled 25 points behind Dean entering Iowa. Then there was the great Joe Lieberman, the most sickening, hypocritical, whiny candidate to ever make a career in politics. Based on a report by the New London Day, his campaign manager and staff quit after they revealed to the press that Lieberman was paying his kids six-figure salaries and was running out of money. Lieberman informed his staff they had to take a 20% pay reduction. All right? Lieberman took temporary residence in New Hampshire while campaigning. He hobbled through the New Hampshire primary with a 10% turnout and quit before he was totally embarrassed in his home state's Connecticut primary. He had reportedly taken in $10 million during his campaign and spent only $4 million. A net return of $6 million went into his pockets. Good job if you can get it. Al Sharpton was exposed to a Village Voice expose on February 5th, 2004, entitled Sleeping with the GOP, which stated his entire campaign was funded by a GOP fundraiser and dirty tricks operative, Roger Stone, whose job it was for the party to infiltrate and destroy Democratic campaigns. Putting up Sharpton was a tease for the black vote. According to a Newsmax magazine issue of March 2008, Roger Stone was also responsible for tipping off the FBI in 2008 of Elliot Spitzer's escapade with call girl Ashley Dupree. Roger Stone was kicked off the George Bush 1 campaign after he and his wife placed an ad in the Swingers magazine, and it was discovered by the press. Carol Mosley Braun came into the primary race to offset Sharpton. Her backers feared Sharpton would become the spokesman for Democratic minorities. Then there was Gephardt, who became the fall guy by sacrificing himself to mortally wound Dean's campaign in Iowa. It amazed me everyone, including Dean, never mentioned the $15 billion bailout of the airline industry after 9/11. Funded by the taxpayer and brokered by Gephardt. No one ever heard the terms of that deal. Gephardt made it as far as Iowa with airline union backing and then committed political suicide for the party. How much money he pocketed from his campaign was not divulged, but it must have been enough for him to be comfortable and retire or become a lobbyist for the airline industry. Bob Graham seemed like an interesting candidate when he gave the impression to everyone he might expose the truth behind 9/11 because he was sitting on the Senate Intelligence Committee when it happened. But he didn't. He pretended to plead his confidentiality agreement and classified information. He couldn't raise enough money in Florida to pay for his plane fare up to the debates and dropped out of the race quickly. He was considered by the powers that be as too dangerous and might leak the real story behind 9/11. Wesley Clark, the military golden boy, former NATO Supreme Commander, was brought in to shore up the military-minded Democrats. He stood as a threat to the Republican presidential candidate George W. Bush and Dick Cheney, who both hadn't served in the military. While Bush's dubious military accomplishments was to serve as a pilot in the Texas National Guard during the Vietnam War, and Cheney received 5 deferments to stay out of Vietnam. Well, Clark herded in the defense and war-minded Democrats who might have voted for Bush. Michael Moore finally revealed his true nature when he supported Wesley Clark for president. John Edwards was a chosen boy and little-known architect of the Patriot Act. According to an article in the New York Times in 2004, he was later chosen by Kerry as his running mate, probably prior to the primaries, and was an invited speaker to the 2004 Bilderbergers meeting. His southern drawl and boyish charm herded in the southern state Democrats. His affair with a filmmaker he hired to cover his 2004 campaign became public in 2007 when she had a baby without disclosing the father's name, all while Edwards' devoted wife was enduring treatment for breast cancer. His political career was ruined. Last to be mentioned is Dennis Kucinich, the most ethical and liberal of all the candidates, but unfortunately the most unelectable. His candidacy was designed to take away Nader's supporters who refused to support another candidate from either party. Howard Dean herded in all of the anti-war Bush haters, and Lieberman herded all the conservative and Jewish Democrats, and Kerry herded in all the very confused Vietnam-era Democrats who felt he spoke for them. and Gephardt brought in the unions who felt they were being ignored by the Democrats, which they were. And there was someone for everyone, just as it was planned. My clever co-host, Lila, was first to bring this to my listeners' attention when I became disillusioned with Dean by the spring of 2004. I started to see what was going on and pulled my endorsement from Dean with a harsh statement of him being a shill for the Democratic Party. This ploy by Dean was too obvious once it became known that he had been courting the favor of Al Gore, and Al Gore eventually endorsed his campaign. It became very apparent to me that Dean was an insider and always had been. His endorsement by Gore was a dead giveaway, and that is exactly when his candidate got into serious trouble. Dean was a traitor to his cause and to all who believed in him. He wasn't a maverick who was going to take on the system. He was the system, so much so that Democrats made him the chairman of the Democratic National Committee. And Gore's people took over Dean's campaign and ran it into the ground. Joe Chirpy must have known what was going to happen in New Hampshire and announced his plans to leave the Dean campaign after Iowa. Well, Chirpy got paid $10 million for his trouble, and after developing the most successful fundraising effort ever in Democratic politics, he raised $90 million. The reported expenses of Dean's campaign were $30 million spent through to the New Hampshire primary, and $10 million spent for Joe Chirpy. Right? Joe Chirpy's PR firm for advertising and consulting. Well, $50 million went unaccounted for as unspent and put into Dean's pockets after he ended his presidency. All unspent monies for political candidates revert to the candidate. This is a little known campaign law. So Dean seems to have pocketed an estimated $50 million for his Democratic Party sheep herding efforts. After Kerry's win in Iowa and New Hampshire, and a catastrophic collapse of the Dean campaign, Kerry had a clear field. He could expose himself as the flip-flopping metrosexual, bullet-dodging, self-wounding, liberal elitist, skull-and-bones man that he is. If that wasn't enough against him, he put his wife on stage, and she told the press to shove it. In hindsight, someone could think she might have been concerned that Kerry had a real chance of winning and wanted to take out extra insurance against that possibility happening by publicly making an ass of herself and alienating the press. Let's face it, Kerry's campaign was all downhill from there. One look at his foreign-bred wife with a bad hairdo and speaking with a strong German accent made the average American sick to his stomach. Laura Bush appeared as a charming Southern belle without a blemish when compared to Theresa Heinz. Kerry, who was a husky German heiress to a Jewish ketchup fortune, whose voice sounded like she smoked four packs of Camel Straights a day. I'm certain that others must have wondered, as I did, why a woman who was extremely wealthy couldn't hire a makeup artist and a hairdresser to help her out before she spoke publicly. After all, Kerry's hair was so coiffed, it never moved, even in heavy winds. Every time he appeared on Meet the Press or some other show that demanded camera close-ups, he was obviously Botoxed. I can't believe it when it went unnoticed by anyone, that his face always seriously sagged and suddenly became wrinkle-free when he appeared in close-ups. John Kerry, his last statement in 2004 was, "I concede." Yeah. I don't know what happened here. I lost my... I'm sorry. Here we go. John Kerry's last statement in 2004 was, "I concede." He wasn't heard from again until well after Christmas 2004. It was reported by an internet source that Kerry and his wife immediately flew to Vail, Colorado on a ski trip with Arnold Schwarzenegger and Maria Shriver. Kerry was a complete and utter disgrace. His campaign made over $100 million, and his reported expenses were approximately $50 million. He took home $50 million, less the $6 million he lent to his own campaign. He refused to help pay for the cost of those who contested the illegal voting machines and the results of Ohio, New Mexico, and Florida, even though millions of votes were determined to be uncounted. Neither would anyone get help from the Democratic Party. Kerry took a dive, just as Dean did. How much money he shared with Edwards is questionable. For some reason, I doubt if Edwards got anywhere near half, but Edwards had his own funds from his candidacy that he could keep. Bush didn't steal the 2004 election. The Democrats did everything in their power to give it to him. What were the Democrats going to do with the White House or Congress? If they won, they would have had to get the country out of Iraq. If they won, they would have had to repeal the Bush tax bill. Every member of the House and Senate were in the 1% tax bracket and received a minimum tax refund of over $90,000 because of the Bush tax bill. If they won it, would prove to the world just how totally incompetent and clueless the Democratic Party and their chump for a candidate really were. By November 3rd, 2004, I was committed to never voting for any candidate or a party, major party again. I also committed to never allow myself to be swayed or pressured by a phony election, phony candidates, or a completely phony system of selected government. On election day of November 2004, I was swayed by my absolute disgust of G.W. Bush and the Republican Party to cast my vote for Kerry. I have vowed to regret that action for the rest of my life. I apologize to my listeners on the air the week after the election. If anything I had said on the air swayed their vote for Kerry, I would have been a far more patriotic and moral decision not to have voted at all in the 2004 presidential election. The following essay appeared on my website several days after, this essay appeared on my website several days after the 2004 election as a reaction to my disgust at the Democratic Party. I wrote two essays shortly after the elections, which appear in the essays and insight sections of this book. The essays are entitled The Death of the Democrats, An Obituary, and Howard Dean's The Judas Goat. And that's chapter 4 and chapter 5. Chapter 3 and chapter 4 of my new book, Naked at the Mic. Survival of a Liberal in a Time of Peril. And it's not on bookstores yet. It will be, I'm hoping, available by the middle of December. And possibly the ebook may be available earlier. But we will find out. I'll let you know. It'll be posted on my site. And I'll mention it here on the show and many other areas. So thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed the read and the book, and wish you good night. Okay.